This is a download.
Want to say thank you for your time, actually.
You're very welcome.
That's very kind of you, so thank you very much. I really appreciate this.
What I would like to do is this. I have got the original podcast that you and some of your colleagues made.
Yeah.
I listened to it last week, made a few notes in my own limitable handwriting that you now can't read, but anyway. There were a lot of things that I agreed with. There were some things that I disagreed with.
Okay.
But the point of this is nobody, no lawyer is necessarily right or wrong about anything. And what I really wanted to do, rather than deliver a lecture, is to go through podcasts, stopping it from time to time, discussing things that I may agree with or I may disagree with, and if there are things that we disagree on, then you are encouraged, more than welcome, to say what you think and why you think it. And hopefully, when this is recorded and is played back, in exactly the same way, the people who are listening to it will be encouraged to discuss the points and argue them out as well. Right, what I wanted to ask was, whereabouts are you in what I call the legal sausage machine? Right at the beginning of a legal course, halfway through it, heading towards the end, or what?
Oh, the actual LPC that we're doing?
Yes.
A little bit before the middle. Our core module exams are in February, so we've been here for 3 months.
And I take it that the Bribery Act itself isn't a part of anything that you're doing on any curriculum, is that correct?
Yeah, it's got nothing to do with our core modules. It's just Shidley gave us some topics that we could research and then discuss. That's why I chose the Bribery Act.
Good, because when it comes to, I don't know whether you've got any interviews for people who training contracts or anything like that. It's the kind of subject that, not being on a curriculum, but having a commercial as well as a legal angle to it, simply a bit of a knowledge of, will be of assistance. You can talk about something that not everybody else is talking about. Right, so where should we go? I will start the podcast.
Yes,
And I'll stop it.
Listen on your music player.
Well, big businesses, corporate companies.
Let me just pause there. Was that you talking, Grace?
I think so.
Question, who gets entrapped in this kind of thing? And you say big business and large corporation. Why was it that you chose just them?
Well, looking back on it, after I listened to it, I think it was a mistake because obviously it's directed at corporates as well as individuals. So an individual can give a bribe and or receive one, and that would still be an offence. So I think it was a bit misleading, my answer. I basically said I think the answer that I gave was quite misleading because after listening back to it, obviously the Bribery Act is directed at corporates and companies as well as individuals.
Yes.
So it's both organisations as well as individuals who either give a bribe or receive bribe, and is not just companies as such. So I think that answer was very misleading.
I wouldn't have used the word misleading, possibly incomplete is a better word. For obvious reasons, everybody now knows about Munir Patel's little difficulties at Redbridge Magistrates Court. The joint prosecution guidance between the SFO and the CPS does specifically refer to investigations into lower level bribery as well as corporate level bribery, and it makes a specific reference to potential for bribing people in, for example, local government, be they planning officers, even driving test examiners and things like that. Have you, this is not a plug, but just a way of directing you towards the information, have you waded your way through the blog that I do, the Bung blog?
Most of it. My main focus was the Munir Patel case that you wrote about, as well as hospitality.
Yes.
Those are the main things I read about, which I thought might have been relevant to today.
Yeah, well, we'll come on to hospitality in a minute. But one of the things that I have been trying to emphasise, as indeed have a few other lawyers who hopefully do know what we're talking about, rather than the ones who are going with the scare tactics, is that the Act itself really does cover the whole spectrum. Now, when Patel was first prosecuted back when he was first charged under the Bribery Act back in August.
When you wrote, government says bribery is not an offence, and then I lost you after that.
Oh, right. Well, basically, the point of that part of the blog was to emphasise the fact that although everybody seems to be looking up in the air potentially SFO prosecutions, so that nobody seems to be looking down at the lower level where people like hotel, driving instructors, planning or officers or whatever are just as susceptible to the act. But that's something that I wanted to emphasise and have really picked up on that because of the observation that you've made in the original podcast about it being aimed at big business, and it does go further than that. If we go on with the podcast, because I think we've come up to a question from Shibley where he asked you what led to the passing of the act in the first place. So here we go.
I think it's the Bribery Act's comment is there's been a lot of pressure on the UK government to catch up with other foreign anti-corruption legislation, particularly because the UK has responsibilities under the OECD Convention on Combating Bribery as well. Bribery has been around quite a long time. There's also old statutes regarding criminal offences for bribery already, but this just is a more modern way of forming companies of their actual obligations, making sure that they actually
Right, stop there. Yes, you've been doing your homework. It was very much as a result of pressure from the OECD, basically because though people had said otherwise, our own domestic anti-corruption legislation was basically over 100 years old. Anti-corruption act. There was an attempt to extend jurisdiction under the Anti-Terrorism Act of 2002, so it's easier to prosecute overseas bribery. But there had been a huge amount of foot-dragging, and it wasn't really until, as you all know, the Labour government in the very last year administration ground doing something about it. So there's a plus. You've got that one very right. I'll go on with the next bit.
I'm committing the offence under the Act now.
So under the Act, you will commit it was a criminal offence for either an individual or a commercial organisation to either offer or to receive a bribe. And this is with regards to companies. Both British and foreign companies are covered, provided that they have some operations in the UK.
I'll stop there again, because you've covered quite a few things all in once. The important point that you have grasped is the fact that it is not just companies, it is individuals. You didn't go into the full definition of what I call the domestic offences, Section 1 and Section 2, bribery and being bribed. You said it's an offence to offer or receive a bribe by an individual or corporation. Have you actually gone through the individual Section 3, 4 and 5, which are the essential elements of what makes up the offence?
I went through it a couple of weeks ago. It's not fresh in my mind though at the moment, no.
It's not a memory test. It's what is the definition of a bribe? And there's a reason I mention this, because there's a very good example of it that's popped up just recently over the News International complaint. They couldn't have gotten an air hotel to court unless they had themselves committed an offence of bribery and they didn't leave. Just to agree, it's offering, promising, or giving, not just dealing with Section 1, offering, promising, or giving a financial or other advantage to effect an improper performance of a relevant function or activity in breach of a relevant expectation. Sorry, I know that sounds like a machine talking to me. The important thing is the financial or other advantage, it can be cash, it can be anything. Nothing actually has to change hands, as you will appreciate. To effect an improper activity in breach of a relevant expectation is effectively offering somebody a bunch or an advantage to make them do their job in a way that a reasonable member of the public in the UK would think was a bit iffy.
Yep.
That's about as basic a definition of it as you can give. But the important thing is this. The managing editor of The Sun. The managing editor of The Sun was complaining possible to Richard Alden, the director of the SFL, that The Sun could not have bought Munir Patel without bribing him, committing an offence under Section 1 of the Bribery Act. The editor's complaint was, how can you have an Act of Parliament which will effectively criminalise activities by newspapers they couldn't have bought Munir Patel without committing an offence, and they've been making a big fuss of that because they want Parliament to introduce what they call the public interest defence. which the short answer, and there's been a fair amount of debate about this, is what this some journalist did was to film a man offering Vermeer Patel the money. The intent of the act is to bear an improper performance. Now, the same journalist never actually intended that the improper performance of not giving that man's convictions on a computer was going to happen. What he actually wanted to do was simply to see whether or not Patel was prepared to accept the bundle of notes that was being handed across to him in the video.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody raises this question and you get into a debate about it, the short answer is that in situations like that, and I have no time for the same newspapers, I suspect a lot of other people haven't either, you have got to be able to show that there was an intent to affect that improper performance before there's any question of an offence being committed. So any journalist will start moaning in your direction about the fact that it's not fair to journalism, there is your answer. Now, where do we go to next? Let's start the thing again.
The penalties both include fine and up to 10 years imprisonment. Most recently we've had a case, actually it's R and Munir Patel, probably heard about it. The guy who was a London, East London court clerk, he basically exchanged £500 with people in order to avoid putting their details on the traffic somehow.
And to actually need to stop further, because I remember, you know, there's something here, seeing it tonight somehow. This brings up the idea of evidential proof. But how does one prove somebody has committed an offence?
Well, in this case, he was actually caught by camera by a national newspaper, The Sun, who took photos of him giving a speeding ticket, and then they used all the evidence where he, I think, took money from the person who got the ticket, and they reported it.
So there's been one case. What I've always felt is that this is a bit of statute, but we need cases to find the scope of statute. I'll give an example of that. That is corporate hospitality.
Let's stop there a second before we do corporate hospitality. just one final point on the Munir Patel. A few people have been asking the question. He was prosecuted. Let's deal with two aspects to this. When he was sentenced, there were two offences on the indictment. There was the bribery count, which was count one, and there was the misconduct in public office count, which was count two.
Mm-hmm.
He was given 6 years for count two and 3 years for count one, the bribery act offence.
Yeah.
And if you follow the internet, as I expect you to do, you'll see all sorts of people trying basically to poo-poo the Bribery Act and saying that this sentencing shows that the offence is nonsense and it's not being prosecuted properly and everybody expected a big corporate prosecution and so on and so forth. Important factors to bear in mind, though, really, are these. The misconduct in public office offence covered a period of over a year. We've been well at it. As I said, 53 people, apparently, at least, have been involved from what police discovered in the for the records. The Bribery Act offence, he was charged in, I think, the second or third week of August of this year with the Bribery Act count. So it could therefore only have covered a period of up to 6 weeks or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It came into force, as you said at the beginning of the podcast, on the 1st of July. I don't know whether or not he was charged with a single specimen count of one offence, but the sentence of 3 years out of a maximum of 10 was something that was a flagrant breach of a very serious bit of public trust. I don't think personally, for what it's worth, could be said to have been excessive. Sure, it's going to be appealed because it's the first case of its kind, but it'll be interesting to see what the Court of Appeal have got to say, bearing in mind there's nothing from the Sentencing Guidelines Council. So the Court of Appeal, presumably, will want to start saying something about the level of Bribery Act offences. The other point is this, which doesn't often get touched on, is that there were 53 people who gave him the bribe, therefore, presumably,
committed the offence as well.
Exactly. There are 53 people of whom the police are aware who have currently been the bribe. And the question has been asked several times, the short answer is, think, unless Munir Patel wants to tell the police, A, who these people were, which they already know, but more importantly, yes, these people gave me money, I personally can't see there's any way that evidentially they can, a case can be established against the people giving bribes, because there is no evidence independently of Munir Patel that they actually gave the money. There's an inference and a suspicion, because assuming the police discovered that these people's details, albeit they were convicted, hadn't finished up on the DVLA computer, I rather suspect we're not going to see any prosecutions.
Well, in fact, it's not bribery, because hospitality doesn't count as bribery. However, there has been arguments that there's such a fine line between hospitality and not. It's going to be difficult to find out whether they are committing this offence or not. I mean, the SFO, it's been argued that they're not going to go through receipts and bills of things which are counted as hospitality with a fine tooth comb. So a lot of people might actually get away with bribery if they're masking it as hospitality.
Right, let me stop you there. I don't know if that was you or somebody else. I understand the point you're making, and I'm sure it's correct to say that the SFO aren't going to sit down and go through everybody's individual hospitality receipts. But the point that ought to be considered, and I know that I and various other people who comment on this a lot are trying to generate, it's not just the SFO that prosecutes, as I've said before, it's the CPS as well, who have a separate jurisdiction and a separate budget prosecution. But what people really have to bear in mind is this. Suppose you have got two relatively small companies who are each competing for a contract to manufacture a particular item. To either one of them, it means the companies will be able to continue to trade, they will be able to continue to employ staff that they have, and they will continue to be a successful company. But the chances are, especially in this day and age, in the current economic climate, suppose the other company doesn't get it, finds that it can no longer afford to continue employing its employees because they don't have the work to do. That company could go out of business and the employees out of work. That's involved. Now, if you have got a situation where each of the two of them have been competing perfectly proper in the tender for the contract, each of them have been demonstrating to the potential customer just how good their product is, as they are entitled to do. And each of them, during the course of the demonstration, hands out pens or bags or something like that as promotional material. Each of them takes the person they're tendering to, let's say to a cricket match or Wimbledon. Thus far, we don't have a problem because there was nothing wrong with corporate hospitality as such. But what they have to bear in mind, and what I really think isn't really concentrated on, is if, for example, the trip to Wimbledon happens to take place in the day or 2 days before the decision on the award of the contract is made, or the trip to the cricket, or the pens that are handed out are, let's say, Mont Blancs and nice little cases of one of the presentations, whereas the other one just does nasty plastic fire. What's going to happen in this situation? A week after the contract has been awarded, the manager of the company that lost the contract is in conversation with the person who awarded it to the other people and says, well, why didn't we win it? And the person awarding the contract says, well, really, there wasn't an awful lot to choose between the two of you. But what really happened was the posh Mont Blanc pen. In those circumstances, you have got a bit of hospitality, but it isn't just intended to promote your company with a Mont Blanc pen. It's a bit of hospitality that is actually designed to affect the decision that the person makes, how big the prize is. Then the losing contractor is going to think, hang on a minute, basically this is a bribe. I go to the CPS and say, this contract has been awarded as a result of an attempt to induce rather than an attempt to simply persuade that it's the better product.
Yeah.
You go ahead and prosecute it. So in those circumstances, you could well find, or a prosecuting authority could well find, that if it is faced with complaints from people that are perfectly valid complaints, that contracts have been secured not on the basis of merit, but on the basis of quality that is either excessive or deliberately and acutely timed to coincide directly with the award of the contract, then much lower level of corporate hospitality could find itself brought within the confines of the Act. I suspect that what you had to say, or what others had to say on this, had a lot to do with Hart's pronouncements at the time that the Section 9 guidance was issued. He was simply trying to industry that a lot of what has been said about corporate hospitality is derived from what Ken Clark had to say when the Section 9 guidance was issued. trying to schmooze industry by saying, don't worry, this is not something that we are going to be terribly interested in. Corporate hospitality is not an offence. What I would say about Section 9 now, without taking up too much time on it, is go back back and read it, because all that Section 9 says is that the government must publish guidance on what are adequate procedures for the purposes of the Section 7 defence. I'm sure you will understand what I mean by that. If you actually look through guidance, instead of just listing what are adequate procedures, the phrase government policy is pops up many times. Now, the Section 9 guidance, the section provisions of Section 9 gave you no authority to say what government policy should be or what the law is. And when these cases start coming to court, as and when they do, I can just imagine the judges are going to be saying, frankly, we don't give a toss what the government say their policy is. The law, as we interpret it, is X, Y, and Z. So people have got to be very careful about sitting relying on Section 9 guidance as to whether or not corporate hospitality comes within the law. You just referred to other countries' anti-corruption legislations having exclusions and allowances that the Bribery Act doesn't. Do you know, do you understand what is meant by the phrase facilitation payments?
No.
A facilitation payment is what's otherwise called a grease payment or a speed payment. It's a small payment that is made, for example, to a customs officer, not to clear something that shouldn't be cleared, but to clear something more quickly than it otherwise would have been. In other words, to jump the queue. Now, under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the United States, payments have been illegal, and that is one of the differences between the two statutes. Why did you think that overseas companies would up sticks and move to China?
Well, it is not regulated the same in China, so I think some companies who would give a bribe to get into transactional business with a certain company might not come to the UK, because under the new act they'll be committing offence, whereas, for example, in China they might not be.
Think about this for a minute. The City of London is pretty much a world centre, both for terms of stock exchange, its banking, and its insurance markets. If a multinational company said, I am no longer going to do business in London, I am going to take all our business away from the centre of those three large areas of commerce, go and base my operations in China, you might expect its shareholders, for a start, would be asking the question, why are you depriving this company of the opportunity to do business in a commercial centre such as London? To which the company's only answer would be, we are doing it because we want to be able to go on bribing our way into getting business. Can you imagine then trying to explain that to the shareholder? That's the reason why, apart from anything else, I do not think that is going to happen. Going back to my notes, one of the participants in the podcast was saying that Bribery Act was a disadvantage to UK companies because it would mean that a UK company tendering for a contract abroad would be less competitive than an overseas company, because the overseas company could bribe and the UK company couldn't. Do you remember that being part of the conversation? It is a point that a lot of people made before the Act came into force. Is it a point that you agree with?
I think, hypothetically it could happen, but as you say, it's like actually getting involved in these transactions is quite obvious when abroad companies deliberately deal with certain countries that don't aren't as heavily regulated as, for example, the UK or the US now. And it is quite obvious, but hypothetically it could happen, but I think practically it wouldn't so much, no.
There is a very good practical theoretical reason at the moment why it shouldn't happen. And this is Richard Alderman, the director of the SFO, had to say very early stage. This basically is theory, and if it gets sufficient government backing in terms of funding for his investigation, it should work. The point he makes is this. If you have two corporations, Company A, which is UK-based, and Company B, which is overseas-based, that carries on business in the UK, if they are both tendering for a contract in, let's say, Saudi Arabia or China to build an airport. Now, if Company A, the UK company, fails to get the contract because Company B has given the Chinese or the Saudis a bribe and has got the contract, what the SFO say is this. You've got two companies. Company A is British, Company B, let's say, is American.
Yeah.
Are both tendering for a contract in China. Company B, the American company, which carries on business in the UK, though its head office is in America, secures the contract by means of bribing a Chinese official. Company A, the UK company, loses out, has got a pretty good idea of how, why it loses out, so it goes to the SFO, blow the whistle. The SFO are very anxious to be given cases like this so that they can prosecute Company B in the UK to send out the message to companies all around the world. If you secure a contract in competition with a UK company by means of bribery, you will get prosecuted in the UK. In the future, with any other company in the UK, the USA, or any of the, certainly the Western world's markets. And so basically what the SFO are saying is, if you bribe to get a contract against a UK company anywhere else in the world, we will prosecute you, we will put you out of business. And in that way, I'll say that the Bribery Act is actually there and is capable of protecting rather than giving them their medal playing.
Straight to your MP3 player.